And I will be interviewing Pat Sanders for the Yukon Charlie Ethnographic Overview Project. We are here at the National Park Service office in Eagle. Pat works for the National Park Service as in charge of the Eagle area. Today is November 6, 2009. The first question is on historical overview, personal background. Where were you born, grew up?
Well, I was born in Little Rock, Arkansas, and I grew up there, and that's where I attended school and college.
Where were your parents born, grew up?
My mother was born in Arkansas, and my dad in Oklahoma.
Where were your grandparents born?
My grandmother and great-grandmother. My great-grandmother was born in Germany. My grandmother was born in Arkansas, as was and on my mom's side. My dad's parents were born in Oklahoma.
I believe on number five you answered it, and what? And asked, what can you tell about the origins of your family people? And you just answered that. Are there any old beliefs, customs, or traditions practiced by you or your family that remain important? And if so, might you be willing to describe some?
Well, I come from an area, colloquially, that there are many, many old beliefs and traditions and customs. Many are based on superstitions, and I will have to admit that I probably am a superstitious person, but much of our beliefs, practical beliefs, are traditional in that they you give a helping hand when it's needed, and it's sort of like the old saying of karma, what you give comes back to you, and that's one belief and custom that my family upholds. So you you give to someone else, and it always comes back to you.
What craft or other specialized activities do you do?
Well, as far as a hobby, this is my most serious hobby. I make miniatures, and that's especially helpful in the winter months.
How would you describe your identity, such as your beliefs, your ancestors, your culture, your connection to the land or community, your language, or combination of these?
Well, because part of my heritage is German, and come from a southern background, but I come from a very austere and simplistic area where people believe and stand by the fact that you have to take care of the land and the people around you in order to sustain yourself.
What else do you identify with that defines yourself and your family?
I believe a strong work ethic. I come from a background of people who had a strong work ethic, strong belief system that intact, that believes in a higher power and believes that you need to be ethical and moral in your dealings on a day-to-day basis and in your long-range plans.
Part 1B, historical overview, community background. What do you know about Eagle's distant past?
Well, I know a great deal, probably because I am an interpreter for the National Park Service. I know a lot of historical accounts that have been written about Eagle, both pre-contact, prehistoric and historic by nature. And so I suppose I know a lot about Eagle's past and about the people of Eagle and then the people of Eagle Village.
How have mining activities in the area affected life in Eagle?
Well, presently they're not having that much effect on the life in Eagle, but in the past, of course, there was a great deal of effect on life in Eagle. A lot of the economic past was based on mining in Eagle, and that people supplemented their income. If not mining, they were preparing to mine, and if they were not preparing to mine, then they were living a subsistence lifestyle and maintaining a subsistence lifestyle in order to continue their mining during the mining season.
Are there any old stories about flood that you know about?
Well, certainly in 1937 there was a flood, and that's been documented, and there's even video of that prior to that in 1936 there was a flood in Circle, and we have video footage of that flood, and so we have seen the effects of flood. We're very fortunate in Eagle and Eagle Village to have a rich photographic history to rely on, and so we can fall back on that photographic history and see documentation of not just in the video footage that we have, but also still photos of flood activities.
What role has the church played in the development of Eagle?
Well, all the way back, the church has played a very large role in the development of Eagle and Eagle Village. Going all the way back, there's a long history of the Episcopal Church, the Presbyterian Church, the Catholic Church. There are a number of independent churches. There has been a great influence in Eagle proper for the church, and right now Alaska Bible Missions does have a very strong following in Eagle.
What role has the school played in the development of Eagle?
Well, for many years the school was the school has been located both in Eagle and in Eagle Village. Of course, the BIA school was located in Eagle Village, and when I first came to Eagle, the school was located in Eagle Village, and the students in Eagle were transported to Eagle Village where they attended school, and then in 1985, at a cost of $1.8 million, the school was built in the Alaska Gateway School District, and that was built here in the city of Eagle, and the students now in Eagle Village are transported to the school here in Eagle, and throughout history we've had a number of amazing teachers. It's not uncommon for a student to be in the 98th percentile in the nation because on standardized tests, because they get so much one-on-one contact with the teacher, with the aides. There are a number of volunteers, and the community members are very, very active in participating in school activities and school functions and assisting with school work. So the school has played a vital role in the development of Eagle and the residents of Eagle as they grow.
How do you feel that life in Eagle has changed with the coming of new residents?
Well, unfortunately, in my opinion, probably due in part to a very lax system of accommodating those that not necessarily are employed. I've seen Eagle work ethic decline. I've seen people that are coming in that are not necessarily interested in working or attempting to to have an income, a permanent income of any kind, and yet are asking for assistance. So I've seen a trend in the last 10 years at least of people coming in and wanting the government to assist them with their living rather than trying to help themselves. And we are an end of the road community. That happens many times in end of the road communities. You have people who are not necessarily self-sufficient, but that's the way, certainly the way it used to be.
How do you think that tourism has affected the community of Nemo?
Well, when the MV Klondike started in 1984, the city of Eagle and Eagle Village as well were really anti-tourism because there was, as the mayor at the time put it, there wasn't even a place in Eagle that could accommodate sales of postcards for the number of visitors that they were expecting to come to Eagle every day. So Eagle was Eagle's anti-change, as are most Alaskan bush communities. You get in your own little niche and you don't necessarily want to change from that. So Eagle was pretty anti-visitor for the first few years. Over the last several years, there has been a change perhaps in that attitude because people are beginning to see that there is some economic benefit to tourism in Eagle. And certainly we have the largest museum square footage wise in the state of Alaska. So in order to continue that effort, the museum and the historical society relies on tourism to help support the maintenance of those museum facilities and displays. So I've seen tourism affect the community of Eagle, not just economically, but also positively as far as allowing us to preserve history.
What draws new residents to Eagle, and what causes residents to decide to leave?
Well, many people are drawn to Eagle because it is the end of the road, it's a challenge, it's a place that challenges your abilities, and some people come to Eagle because they are looking for a small town attitude rather than the big city attitude. They don't want to have to worry about gangs or sirens or commuting 45 minutes to work. That's certainly the solitude, the peace, the quiet. That certainly is a magnet that draws some people. And some residents decide to leave because many times, especially if you have young children, there's not a lot of social interaction. There's not a lot of activities. There are certainly no organized sports activities for students. And so many times people decide to leave because it's better for their family to do so. Also, some people decide to leave because economically it's just not feasible to live in a place where there really is just basically seasonal employment.
What is your opinion of the leadership of Eagle and what ideas might you have?
Well, I think over the past few years, Eagle has suffered from an active participation by the community in assisting the Common Council of Eagle, which is the elected council of Eagle as a second-class city and incorporated city and the first incorporated city in interior Alaska. I think the city council has suffered because the community has not been behind them. It's easy to stand around and complain, but we have not had a great effort to move forward and assist with the problems. I think that we need some way to motivate community members to be more involved with the community.
other historical events do you feel are important to Eagles Pass?
Well, historical events, I of course go all the way back to the Klondike Gold Rush. That's very, very important to Eagles Pass. As far as Eagle Village, pre-contact with white man, there we learn just from looking at some of the things that we have discovered that all the way back as far as 12,000 years, the Han Athabascan have lived a lifestyle of survival. They have been able to respect and live off the land, and I think that events like that, though they're not marked by any specific date like New Year's Eve or the 4th of July, those are historical events that need to be celebrated and need to be brought to the forefront so that we can continue to be better resource managers. And I think that's very important to Eagle and Eagle Village's past, because we've certainly seen the impacts of mining. We've certainly seen the impacts of what can happen when for instance, the 40 Mile Caribou Herd, when things are not managed properly. And then, and right now we're seeing the same thing happen with salmon, and the commercial salmon industry and the pollock fisheries, and how that's affecting us as far as trying to live the lifestyle that we live here.
Part two, subsistence and employment in Eagle. What kind of work have you done in the past while living in Eagle?
Well, the first winter I was in Eagle, I ran the general store, which is no longer around. And then I cut wood for a living for an entire year. I cut wood and sold it independently, and I cut wood for the city of Eagle and supplied all of the city buildings at that time with wood. So I've done that. I worked for the school for 6 years, and I've worked for the Park Service for 22 years.
How would you describe the employment opportunities in Eagle?
Well, there certainly are opportunities for employment in Eagle, but most of them are seasonal employment. And I think if you're motivated enough, you can certainly find something to employ yourself. But we don't have a big want ad section in Eagle trying to hire people. It's difficult to even find somebody to work, and that's unfortunate because there are opportunities there. Just trying to find someone that's willing to work.
What does subsistence mean to you, and do you participate in subsistence activities in the Eagle area?
Well, subsistence is a lifestyle. Subsistence, by its very definition, was a form of survival. But once you've done that, then you've created a lifestyle. And subsistence is a lifestyle. We participate in a subsistence lifestyle. And yes, I do as well. It's sort of like the case of if you don't have it and you need it, you either make it or you do without it. Subsistence means to me, in my particular case, referring to harvesting and collecting and utilizing the resources, the renewable resources that are available to us, and utilizing those to the very best potential to continue your lifestyle.
When do you hunt, fish, trap, collect, and why at that time of the year?
Well, of course, I do most of my hunting in the fall, sometimes in the winter. The reason for that is because that's the proper time of year. It's certainly not mating season, and it's the time of year when you can preserve your meat better for taste, as far as that goes, unless you're just canning it or freeze drying it. If you want to, or drying it, smoke drying it, if you want to freeze it, then you're going to have to wait till the weather's cooperative, unless you have a large storage capacity. And fishing, we fish, you can generally expect to catch the first king salmon around the 1st of July, and then you catch chum after that, the first run of chum. And I collect berries, and I collect mushrooms during the summer months, and depending upon what kind of mushrooms I'm looking for, the ground temperature has to be a certain temperature in order to collect, for instance, morel mushrooms, and I would do that right after a fire or in a fire area. And then boletas, puffball, shaggy mane mushrooms, and then later I will, around July, I'll collect raspberries, and then after raspberries, then I'll generally look for blueberries, and then after the blueberries come the cranberries. And I do that because that's, as far as collecting or harvesting berries or mushrooms, I do, it's a seasonal thing to do. And the trap line, of course, when I did trap, I trapped during the regulated seasons. And you do that, the seasons are what they are because, number one, it's your fur is best during the winter months, and number two, because, well, maybe this should be number one, that's the law, but you can't use a fur in the middle of summer, and you certainly don't want to catch something that's in mating season or about to mate.
How have state and federal regulations helped or hindered your subsistence activities?
Well, I think this is probably a pretty sore spot with most people that live in Eagle and Eagle Village. State and federal regulations have hindered our subsistence activities, certainly because the sport season is opened up, and then they allow harvest for sport use. And depending upon the migration of, for instance, the caribou, specifically speaking of caribou right now, they'll shut the season down 4 days after it opens, which doesn't give the people in Eagle or anyone in the area the opportunity to actually hunt. So sport hunters are seeing far more benefits than the subsistence hunters are. So they have definitely, the regulations, both state and federal, have hindered our subsistence activities, specifically in caribou. Moose, we have a very dense moose population. It's even down further than it was. I think it's one moose for every 4 points. Well, I forget. But in any event, it's a very thin population. So we see people come in here with huge motorboats, and they have the economic ability to go down, and they're hunting for horns. We're not hunting for horns, we're hunting for meat. And so I think probably you're going to find that more people in the Eagle area that depend upon subsistence hunting activities feel that sport hunting and hunting for horns rather than meat is the bane of our existence at the end of the road.
How have state and federal regulations affected community subsistence activities?
I think the same way, with the exception of potlatches, the celebration or honoring of a native who has who has passed away or is getting married some such special event, they have affected, except for that, they've affected the community the same way they've affected individuals, because we are a great big extended family, both in Eagle and Eagle Village. I mean, we depend on one another and we share when we can, and that's very important. So I think as far as state and federal regulations, it's probably hurt the communities as much as the individual, and in the same way.
What ideas do you have for people's economic stability?
Well, I think you have to plan for growth. I think that we're still logistically, it's difficult to get to Eagle, but I think people are still out there that want to challenge themselves, and they want to visit areas such as Eagle and Eagle Village. And I think the only economic stability we're going to have is if we prepare for visitation, because I certainly don't see any industrialization coming to the area. I don't see the area being opened up to mining again. I don't see a great deal of push toward the fur market, so I think that the only economic stability we're going to find is going to be related to or directly involved with tourism.
Do men and women do the same kind of work in Eagle, or do they get to different kinds of places? What about in the past?
Men and women do the same kind of work in Eagle. If the wood needs to be hauled, then you haul the wood. If it needs to be cut, you cut the wood. If fish net needs to be checked or the fish wheel needs to be checked, then both sexes do that. The only time I have ever seen a separation in duties between men and women is in the course of a funeral or a death. And that at that particular time, I've seen the women will, if it's in the winter, the women will prepare sandwiches and hot coffee and make sure that the men are warm while the men are out chopping and digging a grave inch by inch. And then the entire community will fill the grave in. But that's the only time I've ever seen in the past as well. You have to be prepared, regardless of your sex, to do what needs to be done. And you have to know how to do it, because if your husband or spouse or partner should have an accident of some kind or should befall some kind of illness, it's up to you to make sure, as a woman, to make sure that you're prepared to take that part and that burden on yourself until your husband or partner or spouse can heal and take the wheel again. So the only time I've ever seen duties, as far as separate duties, and that includes the married folks. I mean, most of the men in this community, there are many men in this community that are far better bakers than the women.
Historical overview, part 1B, community background.
No, we already did that.
I'm sorry, we're going to part 3, experience of flooding and climate change. Were you here in 1975? Can you tell me about the land and what the weather was like?
I didn't get here until July of 1980. And at that time, that was the same year that the state lands were opened for mineral entry. So the lands were a bit different than they are now. A lot of the lands had not been conveyed, native lands had not been conveyed. The weather was a bit different. I think we had more wind, but certainly the winter of 1980 was a pretty pretty heavy winter.
Were you here in 2000? Can you tell me what the land and weather was like?
Yes, I was here in 2000, and the land and the weather, that was prior to the fires of 2004 and 2005. It's a real active fire area. But back in 2000, we certainly had more areas to pick blueberries and that sort of thing. I can remember in 2000, we had a pretty warm spell that in the latter part of June and early part of July that was pretty high temperatures.
Were you here during the flood of 2009? What happened then?
Yes, I was here during the flood of 2009. We watched, as a matter of fact, I videotaped it, and we watched, starting on May the 3rd, we watched the ice rise, and the ice thickness was about 40% thicker than it normally is that time of year, and we experienced the week before May the 3rd, we experienced temperatures ranging in the 70s, 70 to 75 degrees, and at that same time, upriver and in the high country, there was a lot of rain and a lot of melting, so it literally forced the ice to break, even though it didn't want to, and then it flooded down river, and or it jammed down river, and destroyed all of Eagle Village and most of Front Street up to the second terrace, and we even had water in the main part of town on the main street, the low-lying areas, probably in an area as large as a football field. And we had ice pushed up some 100 yards in many places.
What do the elders say about erosion, flooding, and storms?
Well, I remember talking with Grandma Sarah Malcolm years ago about some of the storms that they used to have. And according to her, the storms that we have now, or were having then, back in the 80s, the storms were, summer storms were more frequent, and there was less snow now than there used to be. As far as erosion, that's been a problem probably going that people have been aware of for years and years, which is exactly why the sites that we find that are Pond, Athabasca, and Village sites are built on very high banks and away from flood zones.
How has the community reacted to floods in the past? Evacuation, moving houses, protecting kids and elders?
Well, we've certainly never had in the history of Eagle, in recorded history, we've never had a flood such as 2009. So if you talk to people, you'll find that breakup is a time of year that is always a joyous time. It means that we've made it through winter, and it's a time to celebrate. But we've certainly never seen floods such as we had this year. But it is, as I said earlier, an extended family. We've seen floods in 1981, we had a flood. In 1994 and 95, we had a flood. Eagle Village was flooded then. And as I said earlier, it's a big extended family. So we help one another. And people certainly did in the village have to evacuate several times since I've been here. People have chosen to move, but there has been no major moving until the 2009 flood. And of course, your first concern is the children or the elders. So we take care of one another, we watch out for one another, and because we are like one big family. So that's the reaction we have, whether it's a flood or a fire.
Do you notice changes in temperature, snowfall, rain, rivers, lakes, or ponds in the local area?
Yes, I have noticed we have areas that are definitely drying up, wetlands that are drying up. For instance, Ford Lake historically has always been a wonderful place to hunt ducks. And in history, the journals tell us that as far back as recorded history, people have been hunting ducks and waterfowl in that area, and it's now very, very shallow, very, very shallow. There are areas, there's an area around the 70 Mile River on River Wright that used to be a wonderful little pond to go and hunt for moose, and it's completely dry now. I have noticed some changes in temperatures. I've noticed we have longer spells of colder weather, and then we have, immediately following it seems, we have very warm temperatures. We've had less and less snowfall over the last few years, and we only have about 13 inches of annual rainfall. If it weren't for the permafrost, we'd basically be a desert. The river does what rivers do. They change according to what needs to happen. This river has 2.4 tons of sediment suspension every second. So it's got a lot of, it's a very dynamic river. It's constantly changing. And certainly the flood of 2009 made many of the areas in that river change and accounted for a lot of erosion.
Please describe what the river and the region mean to you in practical and personal terms.
Well, that's a really good question. The river is our main source, major source of protein. We depend upon the river for our salmon. It's unfortunate that the river is being mistreated. Upriver, we're seeing a lot of pollution go into the river out of Canada, and that saddens me. I think, in all practicality, we've got to take better care of that, and we have to seek ways to do that. We have to respect it or we're going to lose it. And it is, as I said, it's a major source of protein for us, and it's a highway. In the winter time, we use it to perform parts of our subsistence lifestyle. We use it for hunting, we use it for trapping. And of course, in the summer, we use it for fishing. So it's a very important part of why I live here.
We will now go on to part four, the Yukon Charlie Rivers National Preserve. What is your overall opinion on the Yukon Charlie Rivers National Preserve?
Well, Yukon Charlie Rivers National Preserve was established as a national preserve in December of 1980. after 1978, when President Carter invoked the Antiquities Act of 1906 and established it as a national monument, and then later it became a national preserve. It's 2.5 million acres of area that has a rich, rich history, probably one of the most diverse areas in the entire state, because it has everything, the geology, the history, the prehistory, the paleontology, the wildlife. There are endangered species of plants that are found nowhere else in the world. And my opinion is that, and the Charlie River is the only complete watershed under federal management, every drop of water. So it is 2.5 million acres of some of the best area to recreate, visit, and study that the entire state of Alaska has.
What has been the most positive thing about the preserve and its establishment?
Well, I think the most positive thing about the preserve since its establishment has been the preservation of the history of the area. The area remains undisturbed, and for instance, the Charlie River, there are so many areas along the Charlie River where you just have premier whitewater experience. And the most positive thing about the preserve since its establishment is that you have 2.5 million acres that people can actually come and enjoy themselves and participate in a part of our lifestyle, in that they can go and they can hunt and they can fish just like we can. It's different than a park. You can still hunt and fish, and I think that's a very positive thing for the people of the area.
What has been the most negative thing about the preserve since its establishment?
Well, I think the most negative thing about the preserve since its establishment is probably the confusion that is caused, because you have over 300,000 acres of private lands within the bright boundaries of the preserve, and that's sometimes confusing for people that are desiring to come to a place and camp or hunt or fish. And so the land status has probably been the most negative thing, because you can't just say to a visitor, oh yes, you can go here. You have to have clear guidelines, and that's the most negative thing, is it's very difficult to explain to visitors, well yes, this area is in the preserve, but it's private land. So I think that's probably, if there is anything negative, it's the confusion about private lands within the boundaries.
What do you know of the people who live in the preserve since its establishment, and what was their opinion of the preserve, if you know and are willing to share this?
Well, I know a lot of, I have many friends that have lived in the preserve before and since its establishment. We have people living and operating under subsistence permits in the preserve. And their opinion of the preserve originally was that it was just going to completely stifle and stop their lifestyle. I have also heard locals say, oh no, you know, the preserve is a bad thing. But you have an area of private land, and if it weren't for the preserve, that land might not be available to hunt, fish, trap, and support yourself in support of your subsistence activities. The people have actually said thank you for being there. You're certainly going to have diversity regardless, because we are a very diverse people. And you're going to have differences of opinion, but that's what happens. Our opinions are welcome, and so we each have them.
Do you make use of the preserve for hunting, fishing, trapping, or any other activities?
Absolutely. I make use of the preserve for hunting. I used to fish right at the bright boundary of the preserve, and I assisted with the trap line in the preserve, and I also used the preserve during the winter to assist a miner who had a claim off the 70 Mile River, but we utilized the Yukon River and the preserve to gain access to that area. And I also have gathered berries and mushrooms from the preserve.
What advice do you have concerning the preserve and its management?
Well, I think that the only advice that I'm qualified to give would be as I'm doing this as an individual person, would be to clearly define what areas are in the preserve and clear up the confusion that people have about what is regulated by the federal government, what is regulated by the state government, because you have an international, not just a federal or not just a state waterway, you have an international waterway that goes through the preserve. So people are confused as to exactly who should be regulating that. And so clear-cut guidelines as to who is supposed to regulate certain areas would be the advice I would give.
Can you describe any of the trails in the area, and what do you know about their use in the past and present?
Well, there are several trails in the area. Of course, if we're talking just Yukon Charley Rivers National Preserve, there is a trail from Slavin's Roadhouse, the historic roadhouse, up across over to Woodchopper, which is a private area. Then there's the historic Mail Trail, which started in Eagle and ended in Circle. A lot of that was burned over in the 1999 fire, again in 2004. So a lot of that area that was the historic trail is not necessarily easy to access, because there are no maintained trails in the area. There's certainly a lot of old trapping trails, old mining trails in the area, but there are no maintained trails. I know a lot about their use in the past because I am a student of history, so I studied the miners and the trappers and the native use in the area. But there are no maintained trails.
Part 5. The future of Eagle. When you think about the future of Eagle, what do you see?
Well, I think if you look at in the past, that can give you an idea of what you can expect in the future. The Eagle's population has always fluctuated. It has been in the thousands, and it has been as low as 15. I expect with economic recovery in our future, I expect Eagle to see an increase in visitation, because it is one of the few places, even though it's logistically challenging, it's still one of the few places that you can come and see a lifestyle such as we enjoy, and you can experience the beauty and the solitude that we see each day, but we do not take for granted. So I see the population fluctuating, but I do see a growth depending upon tourism.
Can you think of, can you think about and then list the infrastructures you would want in the village?
Well, I don't think that's up to me. I think the village has their own governing system, just as the incorporated city of Eagle has its own governing system, and I don't think it's my place to even issue an opinion on that.
There has been a lot of talks about sustainability. Can you tell me what that means to you?
Well, I think in order to describe sustainability, you need to want to dedicate yourself to accepting the fact that you need to be a better steward, you need to be a better manager personally, and you need to be more aware in order to be self-sustaining.
Are you interested in alternative energy source for the community?
For the community, I'm certainly interested in seeing alternative energy sources, and I would welcome any logical alternative energy source, because it's very, very expensive, it's very difficult, we're not always going to be able to rely on fossil fuels, and we shouldn't. We've got a huge, magnificent energy source right out our back door in the Yukon River, and if we could figure out a way to harness that and use that for hydroelectric power, then I think that we should certainly do that. And we certainly have a lot of wind. We can utilize our wind in the winter and the summer, and we certainly have plenty of daylight in the summer, and we can use solar power.
Do you have any ideas about the future of Eagle and where it needs to go?
Well, I say that I think logistically we're challenged, but I think the future of Eagle is going to lie. I don't think we're going to have any industrialism. I don't think that that's even feasible to even think of. I don't think that there's going to be a future in mining. I think that there's not going to be a future huge, massive influx of people wanting fur trade. So I think the future of Eagle again is going to depend upon visitation, and that's going to depend on economic recovery. And I think where it needs to go is we need to prepare for it.
I would just like to take this minute to thank Pat Sanders for giving me the opportunity for me to interview her. Thank you, Pat.
Thank you, Isaac.